If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
If you went on a road trip and you didn't stop for a Big Mac or drop a crispy fry between the car seats or use your McDonald's bag as a placemat, then that wasn't a road trip. It was just a really long drive. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
As I'm sure you already know, this podcast is produced by the team behind BBC History Magazine, and we're pleased to bring you a very special offer. Subscribe to BBC History Magazine today, and you can choose a book worth up to £30. Choose from either Queens of the Crusades by Alison Weir, The Children of Ash and Elm by Neil Price, Agent Sonia by Ben McIntyre, or The Story of China by Michael Wood. Not only that, you'll also get every issue of BBC History Magazine delivered direct to your door, all from just £22.45. To take advantage of this fantastic offer, visit our official online store at buysubscriptions.com/historybook. This promotion is only available for UK residents and while stocks last. You'll receive your book within 28 days of ordering.
And welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Today we've got the latest in our Everything You Wanted to Know series, in which we explore a subject through questions you've sent in on social media and popular internet search queries. Today we're speaking about the Glorious Revolution of 1688 with Ted Valance, Professor of History at the University of Roehampton. Ted's books include The Glorious Revolution, 1688, Britain's Fight for Liberty, and A Radical History of Britain. He's also contributed numerous features to BBC History Magazine over the years. Putting your questions to Ted was our production editor, Spencer Mizzen.
Ted, I thought I'd kick off this interview with one of the top-ranking queries among internet searches. It's quite a wide-ranging question, but a good scene-setter, I think. And that question is, what was the Glorious Revolution? Can you talk us through the milestones in this act of regime change?
Yes. So the Glorious Revolution is the series of events that leads up to the replacement of James II, who's a Catholic, as reigning king, with his Protestant daughter Mary and her husband William, who is the Dutch stadtholder, Dutch leader. They become joint monarchs in place of James in 1689. The trigger really for these events, I mean, there's much longer standing set of causes that we can talk about, and I think you've got some other questions on your list that deal with that. But the immediate trigger is the birth of a healthy male heir to James in the summer of 1688. What has been the sort of the sort of picture in terms of the royal succession before this point is that James is going to be succeeded by his daughter Mary, who's raised as a Protestant. So anxieties about Catholic rule, which have been, you know, heightened by the experience of and memory of the rule of Mary Tudor and the kind of amping up of anti-Catholic fears over the course of the Elizabethan and Stuart periods, are kind of contained to some extent by the fact that people anticipate that James's reign is going to be, he's quite old, it's going to be a relatively short reign, and he's going to be succeeded by his Protestant daughter instead. But what happens in the June of 1688 is that a healthy male heir is born, very unexpectedly, because he has been married to his second wife, Catholic, Mary of Modena, for some time, and they haven't produced any children. So the fact that there is a healthy male child born is a surprise, and it raises this prospect of there being a long dynasty of Catholic monarchs reigning England. And added to that is the fear that has been raised by the policies that James himself has been pursuing during his reign, and in particular his policies to effectively emancipate his Catholic co-religionists. So we're dealing with a period where Catholics are excluded from holding public office, where they're subject to all sorts of legal penalties, and James is working to get these penalties removed, basically by trying to use his prerogative powers to do this, but he's also working to get a packed parliament, that will have MPs in it that will pass the legislation needed to basically repeal these penal laws against Catholics. So the combination of these things, these sort of pro-Catholic policies and the birth of a healthy male heir who would have been raised as a Catholic, really brings these sort of anxieties to a crisis point. And the responses that seven English peers then write to William of Orange, inviting him to intervene in English affairs. Now, for William, there are a couple of things here that are, you know, critical to driving him to supporting this request, to responding to this request. One is obviously the dynastic question and the fact that his wife is no longer the heir to the throne, and though then by association, neither is he going to come into this English inheritance. But the second point is that he is engaged in what is pretty much a kind of, you know, life or death struggle almost for the Dutch Republic with Louis XIV's France. And what he wants is to get England on side in the struggle against France. Now, the prospect of, you know, James with a Catholic heir and a pro-Catholic packed parliament weighs against all of this. So intervening in English affairs gives William the opportunity basically to intervene on behalf of the Dutch Republic. And so in the autumn of 1688, an armada sets out from the Dutch Republic for England and lands in November of 88. And this is a really substantial military force. This is four times the size of the armada sent by Spain a century earlier. And so some historians have described it as basically being a Dutch invasion of England at this point. I think we have to stress, obviously, it's an invasion by invitation, and it's also a force that is actually multinational. There are actually English and Scottish troops as part of this force. There's French Huguenot Protestant troops in this force as well. It looks in the winter of 88 as if there might be another civil war in England. James initially goes out with his army to meet William's force, but at Salisbury, that advance to meet William's force stops. And really what happens here is that James has a real crisis of confidence, basically. His confidence is weakened by desertions from his army, including of leading commanders like John Churchill. He'd go over to William's side. And he's also in poor health himself. James is suffering from these very serious nosebleeds that debilitate him for days on end. So he's basically in a poor state of mind, physically and mentally, and he makes the decision not to press on and engage with William's forces on the field of battle, and instead goes back to London. And that means that we don't see a civil war in England, although there are armed skirmishes as William's forces advance towards the capital, and some of those skirmishes are fatal, so that there is actually violence in England. And there's also a great deal of anxiety, kind of, if you like, imagined violence too. We get an incident known as the so-called Irish Fright in December of 1688, and this is provoked by James disbanding his army, which includes Irish Catholic troops, without at the same time instructing them to disarm. So there's an anxiety that these disbanded troops are going to set about, you know, massacring English Protestants in their beds. And this panic spreads across the country. It's also, this panic is exacerbated by the fact that on the 11th of December, James himself decides to flee the country. He's decided that there's really increasing threat to his own safety as a result of anti-Catholic rioting that's going on in London and elsewhere across the country. That attempt is unsuccessful. He gets captured by some fishermen in Faversham in Kent who mistake him for a Jesuit priest who's trying to escape, and they don't treat him very nicely as a result. But he's allowed to go back to the capital. But then a few days later, really pretty much with the connivance of William of Orange, he makes a second successful attempt to flee the country. And at that point, really, the cards are all pretty much in William's hand. He is the person who has this, large military force at his disposal. So he is the person whose troops can maintain order in this very uncertain, unstable situation. With Mary, you know, they are sort of, you know, the potential kind of candidates here to sort of resolve this political vacuum that's been created by James's departure. And William becomes clear as this sort of crisis develops that he won't accept just being Mary's consort, that he demands a clear share in the executive power, that he demands a share of the title. And so as a result of this and various kind of, you know, horse trading about how we describe the events that have gone on, but the end point of all of this process is that William and Mary are declared joint monarchs in February of 1689.
Just to rewind by a few decades, I thought I'd turn to a question which is submitted by Ian Mason on Facebook. And he asks, did the execution of Charles I still cast a long shadow? I mean, was that the seed of the idea that a king could be removed?
It certainly does cast a long shadow. I mentioned that moment where James is captured by those fishermen in Kent, when he first tries to flee the country. And they basically kind of hold him in sort of under house arrest for a couple of days. And when the nobleman, the Earl of Aylesbury, comes to basically to sort of get James from their kind of custody and bring him back to London, he remarks how much James looks like his father did at his trial. So he's, you know, confronted with this unkempt, unshaven figure, and remarks in his account of this moment that James really looks like his father did at his trial. And I think certainly for James himself, his father's fate is playing on his mind in these months as well. That there's a real risk, you know, he worries to his own life in this moment. I think he exaggerates that risk. I don't think James really is at serious risk here. Where that risk might have come would have been on the battlefield itself. If James had engaged William's forces in the winter of 1688. And it's a risk, actually, that he later, you know, continues to sort of, you know, put himself under in the Irish campaign at the Battle of the Boyne. But I don't think there's no kind of real regicidal impetus here, I think, to this revolution. There are members, members of that invasion force, if you want to call it that, who are on the radical Whig side, who do probably have a kind of affinity and sympathy for that good old cause of the 1640s. And that's, I think that's true. But they're not really kind of the politically dominant figures here. And I think what's being driven at, even in those radical Whig circles, is not people calling for a republic, but people who are calling basically for a limited monarchy, who want much greater kind of restrictions on the power of the monarchy and much greater restrictions on its prerogative powers. So I don't think it provides a model in the sense of, oh, this is how we can kind of get rid of kings. But there is this long shadow that it casts that leads people to have all sorts of anxieties about what the kind of worst outcome might be. And one other thing is that it remains a very kind of powerful way of smearing people. So well into, you know, beyond 1688, 1689, well into the 1690s and 1700s, Tories continually will use the memory of the Civil War to smear their Whig rivals and say, look, what these people really want is a republic. What they really want is to get rid of the Church of England. What they really want is to have kind of, you know, a Cromwellian style kind of radical Puritan government in place. So it's a very powerful kind of set of, triggers almost, to use in political terms, well into the 18th century. But I don't think it's something that provides a kind of a roadmap for anyone. If anything, it provides a sort of what to avoid, you know, what we should try not to get ourselves into, what sort of situation we should try not to get into.
Sure. So why in the 1680s were so many people so vehemently opposed to there being a Catholic monarch?
Yes, I think so. The opposition to Catholic rule partly has to be understood on this background, very long-standing background of anti-Catholicism, which has been, you know, inculcated as a almost a kind of core English value since you know the beginnings of the English Reformation, really, and has been become embedded into kind of English cultural memory through things like Fox's Book of Martyrs. So there is this almost this sort of cultural association between Catholicism and brutal rule and tyranny. And I think that's the thing, is there is this sort of interconnection between politics and religion here. It's not just about a hatred of Catholics, it's also about an association of Catholic rule with arbitrary rule, with absolute rule power. And in this period in particular, that's more powerful because by the late 1670s, early 1680s, the major European power is Louis XIV's France. So the superpower here is Louis XIV's France. And at least through an English lens, this is an absolutist state. And it's an absolutist state which is increasingly draconian in how it treats its Protestant subjects. And that becomes even stronger with the revocation of the Edict of Nantes and the Dragonades that then follow that, and the reporting of that in the English press, the arrival of Huguenot refugees from France with their own stories of that persecution too. So there's this great deal of anxiety about this sort of interconnection between Catholicism and arbitrary power and the suppression of representative institutions like Parliament and the persecution of Protestants as well. And it's worth saying that these anxieties are not just attached to James. One of the reasons why they are kind of long-standing, long-festering, if we like, is that they have long been attached to Charles as well. There's a lot of suspicion that Charles II is secretly sympathetic to Catholicism. This is obviously exacerbated by his negotiations with Louis XIV, and also by, broadly speaking, the kind of more pro-French angle of English foreign policy. So it's not just about James, it's also about this anxieties about his brother too. But that's obviously becomes much more prominent when we actually get a Catholic successor on the throne.
Great. Now, the next question comes from Morris Creek on Twitter, and it relates to one of the key protagonists in a revolution, and that is William of Orange. I mean, his question is, how should he be remembered, and what kind of ruler was he?
So it's an interesting question in terms of how William is remembered, because I think, in fact, he's not remembered very much as a monarch, at least in England. I mean, I think it's a different story in Northern Ireland for very different reasons, where and in some ways, I think the memory of William in Northern Ireland gives us a little snapshot of how he was perceived in the 1690s in England as well. And that is that William really becomes seen as a Protestant champion and also a defender of not just English liberties or even British liberties, but actually European liberties as well. So he's kind of presented as a warrior prince who is going to defend Protestantism from the aggressive ambitions of France, and the ambition of Louis XIV to become a, as it was described at the time, universal monarch of the whole of Europe. So he's not really remembered so much as a kind of person as this sort of vehicle, if you like, for the Protestant cause and for the defence of Protestantism. And in a way, that's something that William himself doesn't do a great deal to address. He's not a very approachable character. He's quite a remote figure. He doesn't throw himself into sort of, you know, getting to know his English subjects. He relies a lot on Dutch advisors, like William Bentinck, who becomes Earl of Portland. So he kind of sequesters himself away a bit with these foreign advisors, rather than getting very close to sort of English politicians. And so there's a sense in which his kind of his foreignness is never really kind of challenged or ameliorated or watered down. And this isn't helped by the fact that he's a lot of the time not actually in the country. He's away on campaign. He's away fighting his wars against Louis XIV. And so he remains very much as this kind of symbol, or in more hostile terms, just as this foreigner, this Dutchman who's come over. And as his reign goes on, and as that war with France leads to all sorts of domestic issues in terms of high taxation, economic crises, that foreignness becomes more of a public relations problem, especially after Mary dies in 1694, because Mary has been his kind of surrogate of, you know, this properly English, properly Anglican figure who does all of these things that queens are expected to do, who's sort of beautiful and pious and wonderful and all the rest of it. And once she goes, that sort of surrogate isn't there anymore, and we're just left with this rather cold, unapproachable Dutch Calvinist who doesn't elicit a lot of kind of sympathy or kind of senses of sort of affection from his English subjects. I think a really interesting, I'll kind of end on this point maybe, because I think I've said quite a lot here, but there probably isn't a monarch of England whose subjects were required as often or at greater length to declare their loyalty to than William of Orange. So after Mary dies, there's a whole kind of effort to get the public to declare their loyalty to William. After a Jacobite assassination attempt in 1696, there's this enormous exercise in getting people to declare public loyalty and forming this association to defend William. And then there are other attempts in 1701, 1702 for further declarations of loyalty and loyal addresses. And what's noticeable about these is the way in which actually a lot of people won't declare that William is rightful and lawful king. They're in fact mealy-mouthed about it. And even though we get sort of tens of thousands of people kind of signing this association to William in 1696, there isn't much sense that all of this activity builds up a great store of kind of, you know, popular support or affection for him. It feels like, you know, this is something that's being driven by the state all the time. You must tell us how loyal you are to William. It doesn't really kind of, you know, feed through into any kind of genuine public affection for him.
Okay, so let's turn to William's main adversary, and that's obviously James II. I mean, I was wondering, and this is quite a popular question among the internet searches, and that is, to what extent did James II's inadequacies as a ruler play a role in his downfall?
Yeah, I think they do play a role in his downfall. I think that James is a less skilled politician than his brother. And I think that's, you know, a view that a lot of historians have come to as well. If we think about the fact that to some extent, what James is trying to do is really what his brother has also tried to do for a significant chunks of his reign as well. And that is to secure a broader religious toleration that will include Catholics as well as Protestants. Now, we know, you know, for James that certainly is the result of his own religious affiliations. It may also be the case in terms of Charles, but it's also about foreign policy. It's also about wanting to ally the country with the most significant European power of the day, and that France being a Catholic power, this is going to smooth those alliances through. So Charles is, in some extent, trying the same things that, you know, James has been doing. The difference is that Charles understands where to draw back. He understands where he can't do something through Parliament. So he uses prerogative means and issues, you know, two declarations of indulgence, religious indulgence, during his reign. But he understands not to kind of continue pressing forward and trying to get statutory toleration in place, because he sees how politically damaging that will be for him. Similarly, the crisis, the exclusion crisis towards the end of Charles's reign, again shows this kind of political nous. So Charles knows that these stories of a popish plot to put his brother on the throne are a complete fabrication, that they're rubbish. But he's willing to go along with them until he sees that his own kind of political strength has reached a point where he can basically suppress all of this sort of Whig activity that's driving to try and exclude his brother from the throne. So he waits until his kind of political moment is there. James is different. James, I think, always thinks in a way that people should just do what he tells them. That basically, I think he still, to some extent, has this mentality of the military commander. This is, you know, he begins his career as a military officer and then as a naval commander. And there always seems to be this element of him where he thinks the relationship is just a commander to his subaltern, that they should just do what he tells them to do. And he doesn't have that kind of political antenna to say, I'm pushing things too far here. I need to draw back. I need to, rethink my strategy. He tends to just kind of press ahead, forgetting what the consequences of that might be. And I think we see that when he's driving through these pro-toleration, pro-Catholic policies, 1687 and 1688, that he doesn't, he just doesn't think about the ramifications enough of those. It has to be said as well, though, that it's what James is trying to do is almost, it's almost like trying to turn around a supertanker. He's got over a century of kind of anti-Catholicism to deal with here. And he does try and do practical things to kind of build a coalition in support of toleration. So he is using canvassing efforts almost to try and identify who his potential allies might be and trying to build an alliance to support these policies of toleration over 1687, 1688. The difficulty for him really is, though, that this alliance is built with, you know, broadly speaking, the less significant branches of nonconformity, kind of Baptist groups, Quaker groups, and sort of, you know, merchants and Whigs in English towns and cities. It is not the kind of most sort of substantial, politically significant group in the country. And the strength that Charles's regime had been able to show in the latter years of his reign had been built primarily on the fact that Charles effectively decided to abandon the policies of pursuing positive toleration and going into an alliance with Tory Anglicanism, because that's where the greatest body of strength was politically, economically in the country. And James is trying to sort of do something that is anathema to that group. So he's really kind of pushing very much against the political grain in the country. He's trying to do something which is really very difficult to get accepted by this really powerful constituency in English politics. So I think, there's an extent to which the crisis is precipitated by helped to be precipitated by James's personality. But it's also what he's trying to do is very difficult to do, I think, politically in the late Stuart context.
I mean, would a stronger king stroke commander been able to repel William's invasion militarily?
I think there's an interesting counterfactual there. You know, what would have happened if James had not turned back? I think my hunch is that the outcome would not have been good for James, though. My hunch is that the outcome would have been a similar one that he faces at the Boyne, actually, because although numerically William's force is smaller, I think the assessment of most historians is that it is a better trained, more experienced, more disciplined force. And certainly what we see in terms of the desertions that take place, not just of high-ranking officers, but of rank-and-file soldiers from James's army, indicates that that James's army is not going to hang together as well as William's will. So my hunch is that James would not have come off the better if there had actually been pitched battles in England.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
It's creating a coercive system of labour, both in England and across the whole Atlantic system. And so from that perspective, it very much is not glorious.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it. So your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Okay, the next two questions are, I think, kind of related. The first one is from Bob Brandon on Twitter, and he asks, was this actually a successful Dutch invasion of Great Britain? And also, the other question is from JSM History on Twitter, and he asks, to what extent does it meet the definition of a revolution? So I wonder if you could just discuss that a little bit.
Yeah, so, I mean, the idea of this as a Dutch invasion has become more prominent in terms of the scholarship on 1688, and I think this is something Jonathan Israel in particular has kind of emphasised, this idea. We do, I think, obviously need to modify that a bit, as I said, by acknowledging that this is not purely a Dutch force. It is a multinational force, although it's primarily made up of troops, Dutch troops, and troops who are funded by the Dutch Republic. It is obviously, you know, fully equipped, I think, not just to make a political intervention. It's clearly set up so that William can challenge James's forces on the battlefield if that becomes necessary. And so I think that kind of military possibility is clearly being thought through. But it is an invasion in conjunction with English politicians. It is an invasion that is being done in conjunction with English risings that are taking place in the Midlands and the North as well. So it's not purely about this Dutch force that's landed in the West Country too. There, on that, I think that leads us into this question about revolution here. And this is something that has become, again, much more prominent in recent discussions of 1688. Steve Pinkus thinks that this is the first modern revolution, that it displays all the characteristics of a modern revolution, like the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution. That what we get is really a violent process of regime change, as you described earlier on, Spencer, that we get the sort of, you know, almost a civil war in England. We certainly get violent warfare in Scotland and in Ireland as well. It's contested at sea. It obviously leads into the major continental war, nine years war as well. And it has these elements of kind of popular uprising and popular rioting in England as well. So it has a lot of the features that we might associate with a modern revolution. I suppose where I would draw back from the picture that Steve Pinkus presents is that I'm not sure that we see to the same extent that Pinkus suggests a kind of ideological transformation in the way that Pinkus talks about. And certainly the revolutionaries, or if we want to call them that, themselves are quite keen to state that what is happening in 1688 is kind of a restoration of business as usual, that they're trying to deal with you know, the problems of James's reign and restore English liberties, you know, as they see it. Now, there's some issues with that presentation that we can talk about, but I think there's a sense in which they don't want to talk about themselves as engaging in a kind of radical break from past political practice, and that itself creates a way in which what the revolution is about is kind of muddied, and then as a result gets debated over the course of the subsequent couple of decades. So I think in that instance isn't a kind of, you know, there isn't a kind of imposition of a kind of radical revolutionary ideology, which then everybody has to kind of sign up to, in the way that you would see in the French Revolution happening, that there isn't that kind of radical alteration in that sense. So I think it displays a number of characteristics that I think we now do associate with revolutions, but in some senses it's not as clear-cut a break from the past as I think some modern revolutions are self-consciously try and paint themselves as being.
And Lee Jones Deng wants to know via Twitter, what was the impact of Dutch culture on Britain in the years subsequent to 1688? And what were Anglo-Dutch relations like at this time?
So, I mean, there's a very significant impact of Dutch culture on England, and it actually well before 1688, as well as after 1688. I mean, the Dutch Republic has enormous influence from everything from court art to agriculture. I mean, this is, you know, one of our closest neighbours. It's a society that is linked dynastically to the English throne. So it's a very important and influential European neighbour. In the decades preceding 1688, it is a major commercial and military rival. And there are three wars with the Dutch fought from the 1650s up to the 1670s, as a consequence of this trading rivalry. That then has an impact in terms of kind of English discussions of the Dutch or presentations of the Dutch. And there is, from the Cromwellian period on, a kind of presentation of the Dutch as being a kind of mismatch, not anything kind of culture, a culture whose sort of tolerance is not a positive thing, but shows them as this sort of, you know, weird Babel-like culture where kind of anything goes, basically. There is a flip side kind of representation of the Dutch as well, which is popular in some radical Whig circles, though, which sees the sort of Dutch Republic as an ideal society, as a society that has got things right, that makes toleration work for it, makes it a prosperous country. There's even some kind of quasi-republican elements to this as well, that you don't need to have a powerful monarchy to have a good, stable and prosperous society. So there is, in some instances, a kind of republican moral that is drawn from that. That Dutch influence obviously, you know, increases once we get effectively, you know, a Dutch monarch on the throne. And we can see that in institutional terms as well, in things like the Bank of England, which are modelled on Dutch institutions. So that influence increases. There is, though, a kind of odd thing that goes on here as well, though, which is that from a Dutch perspective, there's the problem that once you have your head of state as also the head of state of another country, there's a sense in which they become neglected, and also a sense in which the relationship between the stadtholder and the States of Holland becomes more problematic once you get this kind of monarchical element added into it with William as King of England as well. So there's kind of anxiety about, you know, what will happen in terms of these kind of power relationships. But it is enormously influential relationship, and not just actually, immediately after 1688. It's been an incredibly influential one through the course of the 17th century as a whole.
Great, thank you. And now, Fabrizio Del Dongo wants to know, when was it first called glorious and by whom? And I guess that also leads on to the question, should the Glorious Revolution even be called glorious? I mean, it's kind of got this, correct me if I'm wrong, but kind of in England, at least quite a benign reputation, one that is seen as a keystone of British liberalism and freedom of expression. I mean, do you think that's justified?
So I'll deal with the first bit first. It's usually been attributed to the MP John Hampden coining this phrase in relation to 1688 in a debate of, I think it's November 1689. But as has recently been pointed out, it's not actually the first time that this phrase is used. The phrase is used earlier actually to refer to the restoration of Charles II. So that's described as being a glorious revolution. And that gives you, you know, an interesting insight into this terminology of revolution, that it can be used to talk about regime change having happened. And certainly we know from the work of historians like Tim Harris that contemporaries do recognise that a significant change has taken place, that something like what we might now call regime change has happened. But at the same time, there are people who are using this language of glorious revolution, where what they mean is a kind of a restoration back to things as they should be, so that James's reign is the disruption, is a breach from political and religious norms. And what William's sort of crowning is doing is bringing England back to where it should be, is a restoration. Now, that terminology of glorious revolution, I think, has also been taken as meaning this is a set of events which is kind of providentially willed as part of a divine plan, and it's a set of events which happens without the need for kind of blood shedding and for violence and popular unrest. And certainly that was a key element of what we call the kind of Whig version of 1688, and certainly the version that kind of was embedded in a lot of 19th century histories of these events. And that's really a really problematic picture in a number of respects. It's problematic from the point of view, first of all, that the revolution really doesn't clearly secure liberties in the way that that kind of triumphalist picture suggests. So if you take something like, you mentioned freedom of expression, well, there isn't really any kind of formal acknowledgement of freedom of the press. There is the lapsing of the Licensing Act in 1695. But as historians have shown, really what that does is just shift how censorship is applied. So licensing is pre-publication censorship. What happens after 1695 is that censorship moves to being focused upon post-publication censorship. It's not that people, stop thinking we should censor things for religious or political reasons. That continues to happen. It's the mechanics of it change. Now, we do get a much more kind of vibrant print culture post-1688. That's certainly true. But it is not, something that is underpinned by some kind of, fundamental acknowledgement of the right of freedom of the press. That's much more contested. And the same goes for things like toleration. You know, yes, we get statutory toleration, but it's a limited toleration. It's actually more limited than the toleration that James was working for. It's only a toleration for certain Protestant groups. And that statutory toleration itself is heavily contested and argued over the 1690s and 1700s. For a lot of high Anglicans, this is toleration means a kind of temporary sop. This is something that should be reconsidered and probably got rid of, you know, once you've dealt with the emergency of the last year of James's reign. We should be looking at, you know, going back to a situation where it's the Church of England or nothing. So these things are not kind of underpinned by the same kind of constitutional guarantees that eventually follow in the American Revolutionary case. And so that's one thing. I think the other thing that a lot of historians have emphasised in recent years, and it's really important for us to acknowledge this, I think, is the way in which the Revolution of 1688 contributes to unfreedom, not freedom. Okay, so one of the key things that happens after 1688 is that the monopoly of the Royal African Company over the transatlantic slave trade gets broken up. And that leads to an exponential increase in Britain's involvement in that slave trade. So as historians have pointed out, the arguments over freedoms are arguments over things like freedom of trade. They don't consider how that impinges on the freedoms of black Africans, or that is not seen as problematic. And it's actually not just in that context of transatlantic slavery, of chattel slavery. Historians now are emphasising the way in which revolutionary ideology, the ideas of people like Locke and people in his circle, also contributed to unfreedom in England as well. That a lot of these writers are talking about the problems of what they see as being the idle poor, and the way in which they see that the idle poor should be dealt with is through something like the workhouse system. That the problem is that these people are basically lazy, and that they need to be put through a system that will make them work, will make them productive. So they must be compelled to labour. It's creating a coercive system of labour, both in England and across the whole Atlantic system. And so from that perspective, it very much is not glorious.
And what was the impact of this event on, firstly, the island of Ireland and Catholics in England, Scotland and Wales?
So pretty catastrophic, really, I think. And that's another thing, obviously, we have to bring into this picture of, you know, talking about it as glorious. That's a very Anglo-centric view. If we look at it from an Irish perspective, also from a Scottish perspective, this revolution has to be secured by force of arms. So you know, we get pitched battles in Scotland and in Ireland, very bloody warfare, not quite as horrific as the civil wars of the 1640s, but pretty bad nonetheless. And the end result of these conflicts is basically, you know, the securing of Protestant ascendancy in both Scotland and Ireland, and the subjugation of, and kind of, you know, basically political exclusion of the majority Catholic population in Ireland. And that obviously has a very long, very bitter legacy in Ireland and in Northern Ireland in particular. And it's worth stressing as well that it is not a happy set of events for English Catholics either. What we see in England too is a reinforcing of that Tudor and Stuart penal legislation against Catholics, and new financial penalties against Catholics as well. So the land tax that's imposed from 1692 onwards is imposed at double rates on Catholics' estates. So Catholics are being penalised even more than they were in the Restoration period. So there's a kind of rise again of anti-Catholicism in an English context, as well as this process of, you know, politically excluding Catholics and economically excluding Catholics in Ireland as well. So it has a very negative set of consequences for Catholics across Britain and Ireland.
Okay, and Stephen John Lovell, who's written on Facebook, he wants to know how influential was the revolution in terms of its impact on the thinking of revolutionaries in France and America?
Yeah, it certainly does have an influence. I think what it's important to stress is that they are influenced by a certain version of events, a certain version of 1688. So I've talked about a lot about the negative consequences just now of 1688 in terms of religious persecution of Catholics, of warfare, of growth of the slave trade and so on. This is not part of the picture that the French revolutionaries and the American revolutionaries see. They're getting sort of the tarted up Whig version of history, where what this is about resisting tyranny, resisting people who are a monarch who is threatening English liberties and creating a political system which provides checks and balances that will stop royal absolute power from doing that. Now, you know, as I've said, that's something of a misrepresentation of what goes on in 1688, but it's a very powerful myth that it is a significant influence on the early stages of the French Revolution as well as on the American Revolution. So we get this group, in the early years of the French Revolution, the Monarchians, who believe that what they really want to do is kind of put in place a 1688 for France, that they're going to kind of clip the wings of the Bourbon monarchy and they're going to kind of establish this balanced political system and everything will then be fine. And of course, very quickly, you know, events outpace all of this. There's actually an interesting kind of more conflicted, I think, legacy in American context, which scholars have recently emphasised. We used to just emphasise this idea of the kind of inheritance of 1688 being that American colonists thought they had the same liberties as subjects in England, and therefore they had the same right to resist royal tyranny when they saw it, as the English had done in 1688. But there's something else that's going on here too, and that's actually the influence of those revolutionary ideas propagated by people like Locke. And that's the belief that, in fact, that once they settled in North America, they were basically in a kind of state of nature, as Locke had described it in his Treatise of Government. And so they were really building government from the ground up. And so they didn't actually need they were basically independent states. And once the crown started interfering in this independence, then they had, if you like, an absolute natural right to resist that interference. And that, again, is a very interesting and different way of looking at things, because it was a way of looking at things that also automatically, if you like, was taking away the rights of indigenous peoples, was saying that this is a state of nature. We were here in this completely natural state, free to set up our own society. There weren't any kind of pre-existing societies that we had to deal with. And then, you know, we created our own societies, which we are free to defend. And this is actually something that Jefferson talks about in some of his writings as well. So he's not just about that history of 1688. It's also about this idea of, how societies form, and this idea of a kind of settler commonwealth that is created from the ground up.
And finally, Ted, I wonder if you could just explain what you think were the chief legacies of the Glorious Revolution in terms of altering the trajectory of British history.
Yeah, I think one key part of the old picture, if you like, that we must sustain is the importance that the revolution places on Parliament, and that is then sustained through the 1690s and 1700s. So Parliament is critical to driving through the revolutionary settlement. And as a consequence of England's involvement in war against France, Parliament becomes much more of a permanent fixture of the political landscape. It's no longer this Stuart event that is called and dissolved at the monarch's whim. It becomes much more an integral part of the government of the nation. The other kind of critical consequences, I think, of the revolution are that we do get a political culture where increasingly the disagreements and divisions are being resolved through party politics and through elections rather than through, you know, rebellion and through conspiracy. Now, not to say that these things kind of go away, but this sort of vibrant kind of political culture that all this generates creates this sort of different set of channels through which things are being generated. I think the same goes on a religious side as well, that it does move England into a position where religious pluralism is a fact of religious life. It is not, you know, a society in which it's a complete religious free-for-all, or in which, you know, things like anti-Catholicism or prejudice against nonconformists has gone away, but it is a society in which nonconformity is now a fact of life, and religious pluralism is a fact of life as well. I think it's also a critical moment in terms of the expansion of English and British empire, both for ill as well as good. You know, I think we need to acknowledge those negative, very negative legacies of the revolution as well. And those are legacies of imperial and colonial ambition. And they are things that obviously also blow back against the British state later on in the 18th century, that the creation of this much more interconnected first British Empire becomes something that is then provides the opportunity to resist and challenge that imperial system towards the end of the 18th century, on the basis of those, you know, in part of those arguments of those shared liberties and shared rights that I was talking about a moment ago.
That was Ted Valens. His book, The Glorious Revolution, 1688, Britain's Fight for Liberty, is out now, published by Abacus. Thanks for listening. This podcast is produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Join us tomorrow when Giles Tremlett will be speaking about the international brigades of the Spanish Civil War.